And now we will turn our attention to chapter 15. Now, we're going to talk about the Milky Way in this chapter. What is the Milky Way? If you hear that term, what does it mean to you? Candy bar? Okay. That's why the Large Magellanic Clouds is often referred to as Snickers, a companion galaxy. Call on a student and he says, "You're joking, right?" You know, that reminds me of when I was in law school. Did I tell you this story about the answer to give to a professor if you don't know what the answer is? Did I give you that priceless advice? Here I am, my first week at Harvard Law School. And like everybody else, I'm thinking, what am I doing here? And I was sitting in a classroom about the size, well, it was bigger than this because there were about 300 students in the class. And you don't want to act like a complete idiot at this stage in your career. And I'm sitting down here in the front row next to this hippie. And the professor asked this extraordinarily complex question. I couldn't even fathom what he was talking about. And nobody in the class was prepared to answer it. So he walked over. He was out of the whole class. He started to walk right over to me. How is this possible, I'm thinking. And just at the last second, he veered off, and he asked that hippie. And he looked up at him and gave an answer that I've never forgotten. And it's gotten me out of a lot of tight scrapes. He looked up at that professor, and he said, "Do you mean that in an ontological or deontological sense?" And I can remember the professor, he just kind of started backing away from that guy. You know, "Do you mean that in an ontological or deontological sense?" That teacher is going to back off class. He's going to think, this person has a level of insight that's greater than mine. I'm staying away from this one. And that's what happened. And I've used that, and I leave it with you, class. As I usually tell the students this the last day of class, but because that's all I'm going to hear from now on. But if you don't remember that answer, here's a shortcut. The Industrial Revolution. You know, just think about this. You're in chemistry class, or you're in history or English, and a professor asks you a very difficult question. You just say, "The Industrial Revolution." And again, what's the professor going to do? This person is connecting dots that are beyond me. I don't understand where they're just going to back off. You're an unknown commodity. It's just like a neutron degeneracy. You're going to keep that person from bearing down into your zone of ignorance. And so those are two great answers, class, that have I'm leaving you with some priceless information. Try it out on a class this week and give me a report next week, okay? Spell what? Industrial Revolution? Ontological. It's words about being. O-N-T-O-L-O-G-Y. And deontology or deontological. So ontological, O-N-T-O-L-O-G-I-C-A-L. And then just put a D-E in the front. Okay? What an awesome story that was. I mean, for me personally, it was of great value to me. Now, does anybody know, what is the Milky Way? When you hear that term in a scientific sense, what does that mean? Do you have a common understanding of what that term means? Yeah, do you have a sense that it's our galaxy? Is that commonly understood? Not necessarily? Okay. Well, to this story, we now turn our attention. What is the Milky Way? It's that maybe none of you have ever seen it before. You have to be under fairly dark skies without a moon, and you see that kind of white river going across the sky. How many of you have seen that? Is it awesome? Especially from a really dark sky without a moon. If there's any part of the moon up, it whites everything out and it reduces contrast and diminishes the effect. So you want to go out when the moon is not up from a truly dark sky. Look at that awesome band of light going across the sky. The ancients had no idea what it was. Its nature was not known until Galileo in 1610 turns the first telescope and is dazzled by what he sees. But let's look at the history. The Milky Way, that white band across the sky, it's not visible from light-polluted areas. I can barely see it from my driveway. It was familiar to everyone up until 100 years ago. Emerson once said something to the effect that if all the world was shrouded in clouds, But one night per century, we'd be on our knees in awesome praise and wonder at the magnificent majesty of the heavens. But when we can see it, so often it becomes familiar and common. But up until 100 years ago, everybody was familiar with the Milky Way, even from the downtown. I mean, there were no lights that were destroying the darkness of the sky. But here's a light pollution map of the world. Not many places you can go. Let's take a look at the United States. There's a light pollution map. From the Mississippi east, you can just about forget it, except right here in the heart of Appalachia. Look at Florida. Nothing. Look at the whole northeastern part of the country. And you can pick out cities very easily here, can't you, by looking at those light zones. But you get out here into West Texas, up here into Colorado, New Mexico, Montana, Nevada, Utah, even eastern Washington and Oregon. You got a lot of dark areas because you're getting into the Rocky Mountains. You know, those mountains there that were built by British Columbians to keep the barbarians from the south from invading Canada. But that's why we can't see the Milky Way if you live east of the Mississippi. But if you go to a truly dark area, like me at Kitt Peak Observatory a few years ago, it was just absolutely a mind-blowing experience to see the Milky Way from up there. It looked similar to this. This is a photographic image, so it was a period of several seconds, but I actually could see colors like this from that location. It's about 8,000 feet elevation. Perfect skies, no light pollution to speak of. Different cultures have given the Milky Way different names and interpretations over the centuries. It's common for cultures to refer to it as a river or milk, one of those or both of those terms being used to describe it. Because that's what better words are there to describe what you see when you're looking at the Milky Way? The Egyptians called it the celestial river Nile. The Greeks, the Milky Way, representing milk spilled by the infant Hercules when he was shoved away from the goddess Hera's breast. Galact in Greek is milk. We get our word galaxy. We get the word lactose from that root word. The Romans referred to it as via lactea, the way of milk, the road of milk. The true nature of the Milky Way, unknown until 1610. Galileo turns his crude 9-power telescope toward the Milky Way just to see what it was. Here's what he writes in his diary. Beyond the faintest stars the eye can see, you will behold through the telescope a host of other stars which escape the unassisted sight, that are so numerous as to be beyond belief. What a great description of what you feel like when you look through a telescope. That's with a 9-power, like a Walmart-type telescope. Jump ahead to 1755. The German philosopher Immanuel Kant, or it's pronounced Kant, actually, proposed the spiral nebulae are separate islands of countless stars. What are the spiral nebulae? We'll talk about those in a second. But he's the first person, really, to theorize that these little smudges we see in space through a telescope are not just little clouds of gas, but they're islands of an incredible number of stars. 1785, William Herschel does a stellar census for the first time, counting stars with his telescope near and in the Milky Way. And he discovers that most stars, it turns out, are in the Milky Way. So he deduces that the sun is the center of a flat plate-shaped universe. He invented the phrase spiral nebulae for these countless small spiral clouds that he observed through his telescope. Little smudges, most of them are little ovals. You'll see it through my telescope. And what are those things? Are they just little wisps of nebulae, of clouds? Or are they something more? Here's the Milky Way with planetarium software. Again, looking at I've done this many times, looked here through a telescope and then moved the telescope over here, just explodes with the number of stars that you see. Few stars, many stars, the Milky Way. So we know It has significantly more stars than off of the Milky Way. And that led to the theory that the Milky Way, what we're actually looking at, is nothing less than the center of our galaxy from the edge of the plate looking in. Here's the center of our galaxy right here in Sagittarius and Scutum, those two constellations. And that's where the Milky Way becomes very dense. It's fairly low in the southern sky from our latitude. It's probably about this high up off the horizon is about right, maybe 30 or 40 degrees. Here's a picture I took of it. Incidentally, you see these black splotches. Those are obscuring clouds of dust and gas. If there were no obscuring clouds of dust and gas along the line of sight, you could read the newspaper from your garden at midnight by the brilliance of the core of the Milky Way galaxy. But that light is dissipated as it's absorbed or blocked by the junk that's in between. But you actually can see certain places in the Milky Way where there are windows that you can look, penetrate down close to the center of the galaxy. And this is one of those areas right here in the constellation Sagittarius, surrounding this little open star cluster right here. But you're literally peering down through this little opening, this little window, down toward the center of our galaxy. 1920, Harlow Shapley and Heber Curtis had a very famous debate, often referred to still as the Great Debate, on the scale, or really they called it the scale, but I think we might call it the nature of the universe. And specifically, what were all those countless spiral nebulae? By 1920, photography was emerging as a very common tool of astronomers. And all of these photographic plates would show these just unbelievable number of these little nebulae. And what in the world were these little things? So the great debate was whether those little nebulae were clouds of hydrogen gas or whether they were separate island universes like our own, unimaginable distances away. That was the debate. Harlow Shapley took the view that our galaxy is the only galaxy in the universe, and all those spiral nebulae are nothing other than small gas clouds not that far away. He was dead wrong. Heber Curtis argued that our galaxy is but one of countless galaxies, and the spiral nebulae are those other galaxies. Here is a famous article from the Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada from October of 1920. That recently, modern theories of the spiral nebulae. It was not certain what they were as recently as 1920. The nature of the universe was not understood. Was there one galaxy or virtually countless numbers of galaxies? Then, in the 1920s, Edwin Hubble began to examine the Andromeda Galaxy, a fairly nearby galaxy, 2.2 million light years. It's called M31, with the largest telescope in the world on Mount Wilson, the Hooker 100-inch telescope. And he's able to resolve stars in the outer portions of the spiral arms of M31, confirming that the spiral nebulae are not clouds of gas in our galaxy, but they are separate galaxies, unimaginable distances away. And Hubble used the Cepheid variable distance calculator, or yardstick, to estimate the distance to M31 as being 900,000 light years. It turns out it's 2.2 million, but it was still far enough with his estimate to show that it could not be a member of our galaxy. Now, what are the characteristics of our Milky Way galaxy? Well, it's a spiral. It's estimated to be 100,000 light years in diameter. It would take light 100,000 years to traverse our galaxy from one end to the other, about 1,000 light years thick. So it's about 1% the diameter in terms of its thickness. a very thin plate. And it has a central bulge that's surrounded by what is referred to as a halo. And our sun is located near the edge of one of those spiral arms, quite far from the core of the galaxy. Much of the visible light from the core is blocked by dust and gas along our line of sight. Here's a picture I took of the Triangulum Galaxy, M33. That was awarded, by the way, by NASA. It's APOD, it's Astronomy Picture of the Day, in December of 2004. That was the first color picture that I took with my 5-inch refractor telescope. But if we would imagine this to be similar to our Milky Way galaxy, where would our sun be located? Well, it would be out here, toward the end of one of the spiral arms. And as we'll see in the final chapter, it turns out that's one of those anthropic principles. We're in the exact precise area where a habitable planet could be expected. Here's a depiction of our Milky Way galaxy, looking at it kind of straight down from on top, and then looking at it sideways, and these correlate with each other. Okay? So this is the Milky Way viewing the edge of the galaxy over there on the right, like an approaching wheel coming at us. Edge on, it's called. You can see the central bulge, which is over here, corresponding to the core of the galaxy. It's in the constellation Sagittarius and Scutum. How do we know that? Because the density of stars is much greater in that region. So we deduce that must be the center of the galaxy. Ponder this when you observe the Milky Way. We're out here somewhere looking in at literally the width of our entire galaxy. Okay, here's the nuclear bulge surrounded by this disk, and then there's a halo that extends out to maybe 150,000 light years. The globular clusters that we looked at in the last couple chapters back are all in this halo, as Harlow Shapley discovered. Okay, here's a depiction again of another galaxy, but similar to ours. Here's the core, and here's where our sun would be, about 26 to 28,000 light years from the center. So again, when we look at a picture of the Milky Way, it kind of makes more sense to us now. We're, you can see the bulge here, literally. We're looking at the Sagittarius Scutum region of the sky, and this is nothing less than us from the outside of the galaxy looking in toward the very core of the galaxy itself. And that's why, as we start looking away from the core, the stars become much less common. Here's the COBE satellite that took this image of the edge of the galaxy with an infrared camera in 1990. It looks just like an edge-on galaxy, doesn't it, in space? Okay, let's take a look at some of this physical data. Looking at the thin disk, and that's this blue area right here, and the thick disk, which is this purple area, and then the stellar halo, which is this light blue area extending out hundreds of thousands of light years. Okay, and we can compare these three areas in terms of mass. So if we look back here at the stellar mass, what is the mass of each area compared to the size, to the mass of our sun? Well, the thin disk has 4 times 10 to the 10th power of solar masses, whereas this little larger thick disk would only have a few percent of the thin disk mass, whereas the stellar halo, excluding dark matter, 10 to the 10th power of the mass of our sun. And you can look at these other features here. Luminosity is the greatest, as we can see from these images, in the thin disk. Heavier element abundance is high in the thin disk. It's lower in the thick disk, and it's very low out here. Why is that? There's no supernova eruptions happening to seed the area with the heavy elements that can only be formed through supernova explosions. Okay, here's another photograph showing the galactic center. In fact, as I recall, this picture, I thought, actually illustrated the precise center. Yeah, there's the galactic center right there. Here's a picture from my planetarium software, the Sky 6. And again, you can see the bulge here in the middle, right in the Sagittarius scutum area, those constellations. And it extends beyond those, but those are two of the areas of the heaviest concentration. And there's the galactic center. There's Harlow Shapley, born near Joplin, Missouri, in 1885. And we've seen his name before. Through his study of Cepheid variable stars, he was able to use the data that Henrietta Leavitt derived of the luminosity and distance relationship of several Cepheid variable stars in the Large Magellanic Clouds. And he was able to convert that into a ruler and use Cepheid variables as a standard candle. And that is the standard candle that we use to measure distances out to 60 to 100 million light years away. Anyway, using that Cepheid variable standard candle, he was able to examine several globular clusters and determine or estimate their distance, and discovered that they all tend to form a halo around the bulge or the core of our Milky Way galaxy. And so he speculated from that the halo, the middle of the halo, would mark the center of our galaxy, which ended the assumption that the sun is the center of the universe and of our galaxy itself. In other words, if we're way out here on the side and we're looking at this vast halo of globular clusters that form kind of a large sphere in a completely different area of the galaxy, that must define the center, the middle of that sphere, not us way out here in the corner. So Shapley determines, by his study of the globular clusters and the halo, measuring their distances using the Cepheid variables, that the sun is not the center of our galaxy. Very important finding. Whereas Hubble, as we've seen, discovers that these nebulae are not clouds in our own galaxy, but rather are separate galaxies of islands of stars containing tens or even hundreds of billions of stars. And ours is not the only galaxy in the universe. We're one of countless galaxies in the universe. The Milky Way galaxy. And what does this remind me of? The first reference to stars in the Bible, in, I think, Genesis 12 or 14, somewhere thereabouts, where Abram is complaining that he has no descendants to inherit his property. And God takes him outside at night and shows them the heavens. And he said, number the stars, if indeed you can count them. A rhetorical question, as if to say, it's impossible, Abram, don't even try. And he said, so shall your descendants be. Abram believed God, and it was reckoned unto him as righteousness. So here we have the first expression of faith, the centrality of faith in Scripture, and it's tied to astronomy. And God uses, in this brief story, the rhetorical question, indicating that the universe is infinite. Abram could see maybe 3,000 stars, maximum. And yet God refers to the stars as the number of grains of sand on the face of the earth, virtually an infinite number. That's one of the great and one of the early references in Scripture proving its divine origin. And we begin to find this out here in the 1920s through Edwin Hubble. The universe is not just one galaxy. That would diminish God's glory, wouldn't it? But it's rather one of countless galaxies, hundreds of billions of galaxies, it's now estimated, each one of which tens of, if not hundreds, of billions of stars, some of the larger ellipticals, more than a trillion stars in each galaxy. The Milky Way is one of billions of galaxies. The universe is expanding. How do we know that? The farthest galaxies have the greatest spectroscopic redshift, Doppler effect. Here's a map of Missouri showing Springfield Harlow Shapley was born here in Nashville, Missouri. Edwin Hubble was born here in Marshfield, Missouri. Southwest Missouri farms breed world-class astronomers. All right, back to our picture here. It's also interesting that meticulous examination of photographs and stellar sensi, I guess we'll call them, of our galaxy have determined that there are, this is amazing, really, this is in the last 50 years, there are four major arms in our spiral galaxy. That's how we determine that it's a spiral and not elliptical. And that's all by looking at stellar concentrations. And in addition to the main arms, we're on a spur of the Perseus main arm, which is called the Orion Spur, coming right off here. See, it's kind of an offshoot of the Perseus arm, and that's where our sun is located. And you can see from here, we're about 26,000 light years from the center of the galaxy. Our galaxy rotates an estimated once every 225 million years. And therefore, 50 million years from now, the universe will look very different for us than it does now. Just like when we're on different sides and different seasons, the sky, the constellations that we see differ. The same will be true as the Milky Way galaxy rotates. The background galaxies that we see will change. We'll see new ones that we can't see now because we're here and they're over here. Kepler's third law. Let's return to that. We were talking about that during the break. This awesome law, one of the most powerful analytical tools in astronomy. The squares of a planet's periods, of a planet's period of revolution is in direct proportion to the cube of its semi-major axis. That's its radius, that's of its orbit. That's the distance between the sun and the planet. So it looks like this, as we saw back in Chapter 5. One of the consequences of Kepler's third law is that orbital periods are longer for more distant planets, as we would expect. And a corollary of that is that a planet's velocity slows as its distance from the sun increases. Okay? For example, Mercury, the closest planet, has an orbital velocity of 48 kilometers per second. Whereas Pluto, no longer a planet, but it has a orbital velocity of 5 kilometers per second. The farther a planet is from the sun, the slower it is moving. Kepler's third law. And now we can apply that to a galaxy. Stars closer to the core should be orbiting faster than those out here at the edge, right? Absolutely. Some have argued, well, if that's the case, shouldn't that quickly disperse any spiral structure in the galaxy? Like a smoke ring? If you see a smoke ring that's rotating, how long does it take before that's completely obliterated? Almost instantaneous. Well, how is it that we can have a galaxy with spiral arms that's as long as that's as old as astronomers say it is? Billions and billions of years old, and it's had dozens of rotations. How can it have dozens of rotations and maintain the spiral structure? How do the spiral arms persist for billions of years? Well, that was a good question. It was a challenging question for many years until a model was developed called the spiral density wave model. And let me summarize this briefly. The idea here is that in a spiral galaxy, you have spiral-shaped density waves that orbit the galaxy a little more slowly than the stars do themselves. These are invisible density waves. They orbit about the center just like the stars do, but they're going a little slower than the stars. This is theoretical. And as the faster-moving gas and dust bumps in to those slower-moving density waves, what happens? They compress. Their pressure develops, and the resulting compression triggers new star formation. as these clouds of hydrogen gas compress, the temperature increases, and a new star is formed. Once the compression causes the temperature to rise to the fusion trigger point of 10 to 15 million degrees Kelvin in the core of that cloud. Just like a traffic jam, some have likened this to, that you're driving along the interstate at 70 miles an hour, and then, you know, a mile ahead of you, there's been a wreck, and all the lanes are closed. What happens to you? You slam on the brakes, and you come to a stop. And that's kind of what's happening here. The fast-moving stars and clouds of gas and dust catch up with the slower-moving density waves, and they slam into them, and compression happens, and star formation. So there's constant star formation going on. There's some observational evidence that this, in fact, is what's happening, because in all of these spiral arms, we can detect much younger stars than in some of the other areas of the galaxy. And this explains why spiral arms persist and are filled with young stars. We only see the brightest stars, the giants, that burn up quickly and spend their lives on those wave crests, while the dimmer stars move on past the wave but are invisible to us. Interesting theory. That's the dominant model today to explain this conundrum of how spiral galaxies can maintain their spiral structure for dozens of rotations. Now let's talk about the mass of the Milky Way galaxy. How do we determine, how do we weigh our galaxy? You know, this is reminiscent of, in my opinion, one of the greatest experiments in the history of the annals of science. And that was in 1783, when the British scientist Lord Cavendish weighed the Earth with a simple experiment that involved two lead balls. And basically, I won't take the time to go into detail, but he was able to measure Newton's gravitational constant. And with that, he could easily compute the mass of the Earth to within 1 degree accuracy in 1783, using nothing more than a torsion bar and two shot puts. One of the great experiments in the history of science, in my opinion. You can duplicate this yourself with a stepladder, a string, a ruler, and a couple of weights. Well, okay, that was a great experiment. Well, so is measuring the mass of the Milky Way. Boy, it's one thing to measure the Earth. How about a galaxy with who knows how many hundred of billions of stars? We estimate it's got a 200 billion solar masses, but we don't have any idea how many stars are in our galaxy, because most of them we can't see. They're red dwarfs. We may have trillions of stars in the Milky Way galaxy. There may be dozens of stars closer than the Alpha Centauri system. The closest known star to us now is Proxima Centauri in that system, 4.2 light years. There may be 100 stars closer than that, red dwarfs that we can't see. Well, anyway, how do we measure the mass of our entire galaxy? Well, back to our 400-year-old equation, Kepler's third law, as modified by Newton, as we saw back in Chapter 5, measures the combined mass of any two-body orbiting system. It's mass 1 plus mass 2, that's the combined mass of the two orbiting bodies, equals their average distance cubed in astronomical units, divided by the period of rotation in Earth years, squared. Well, that's how we measure the mass of the planets. That's how we measure the mass of binary stars. That's how we measure the mass of galaxy pairs, tens of millions of light years away. We have an orbiting two-body system. Here's pictures I've taken of various galaxy pairs. But how do you apply Kepler's third law to a single galaxy? This is actually not a single, because you've got two orbiting galaxies here too, but let's just ignore them and just say, we have a galaxy like our Milky Way that's basically a single galaxy. It's not a pair with another. Well, Kepler's third law must be modified. And I don't want you to remember the equation or anything, but I just want you to know that Kepler's third law can be easily modified to this equation right here. The combined mass equals V squared times R divided by G, with M is the total mass enclosed within an orbit of the galaxy, a radius R from the center. So any place we want to go from the core outward, we can pick any point and call that R, and we can measure the mass of the galaxy up to that point for the entire circumference of the galaxy by taking the orbital velocity, how quickly the galaxy is rotating, squared, times that radius, and divided by Newton's gravitational constant, which, you know, is 6.7 times 10 to the minus 11th, and we don't have to remember that. But measurements, here's the key point. Measurements reveal, as we would expect, that orbital velocity is highest near the center of our galaxy. When we can actually measure how fast stars are orbiting when we monitor them over several years or decades. And we would expect from Kepler's third law that would be the case. And from this modification of it, the velocity of an orbiting object is inversely proportional to its distance. Farther objects move more slowly, closer ones move more quickly. Okay? And that's what we find here with the closest stars to the center of our galaxy. But here's the unbelievable thing. Recent studies of our galaxy and several other spiral galaxies indicate that the orbital velocity increases toward the center and begins to decrease as you get farther and farther away until you hit about 5,000 light years from the center, at which point the orbital velocity of the galaxy becomes constant at about 130 miles per second. Now, how is that possible? The sun is 28,000 light years from the center, and we have a velocity of about 130 miles per second. Our orbital velocity is the same as a star 5,000 miles from the core of the galaxy. We're five times farther out, almost six times farther out. How can that be explained? Does that violate Kepler's third law? The mass of the galaxy within our sun's rotational orbit, according to this equation, is about 100 billion solar masses, or 200 billion stars, since the sun is about twice the average size. Now, look at a galaxy rotational curve. Here's a picture of the Bode's galaxy and the Big Dipper. Now, if you look at the velocity, the orbital velocity of the galaxy, it should increase with distance. And this is the predicted, based on Kepler's third law, the velocity reaches a peak and then it starts falling off here. It gets slower and slower the farther we get from the center. But this is the observed data, that in fact the velocity increases up to a point and very close to the center, and then it stays fairly constant from that point on, which seems to be a violation of Kepler's third law. And just to set the stage for next week, this became a great challenge to astronomy to explain that enigma of why that is, why the orbital velocities of stars 28,000 years from the core of the galaxy are the same speed as those that are 5,000 light years away. And the answer to that question, just in the last 20 or 30 years, provided the basis for the current understanding of dark matter, which dominates the universe and consists of probably five times more mass in the visible universe than visible matter that we can actually see, touch, and feel. How do we know it exists? The principal basis for this theory is the rotational curves of galaxies and the speed, the velocity of stars and galaxies. Why does it remain constant the further you get from the center of the galaxy? According to Kepler's third law, as modified, that velocity should be diminishing or decreasing. It's not. The only way to account for that is the mass of the galaxy increases substantially the farther out we go. We can't detect that mass. It's not visible to us. But we know it must be there because that's the only explanation for the velocity of those remote stars in the galaxy being the same as those that are close in. And we'll return to this mystery next week.